Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 271 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'm going to be covering COPD and the USMLE exams. Again, it's a super high yield topic. If you're taking pretty much any of the USMLE exams, step one, step two, CK, step three, you're going to get COPD questions. So you might as well just go ahead and understand it now. But if you listen to what I'm saying today, you pay attention to this, you should be able to answer pretty much every question that you see. I'm going to be covering pretty much everything you can see about COPD in this review. So, I mean, obviously, right, we know that COPD, typically on NBM exams, you want to be able to compare it to asthma. And we know that when a person has a COPD, right, they have like an airflow limitation that is not reversible, right, or is not fully reversible. Compare that with asthma, right? In a person that has asthma, the airflow limitation they have is absolutely reversible, right? But in COPD, it is not reversible, right? And really, for the most part, there are two big conditions you want to think about when you're thinking of COPD, right? You want to think about chronic bronchitis, right? Or you want to think about emphysema. And really, chronic bronchitis, the big thing with it is these people are just having a ton of productive cough. I mean, the official definition is you have a person has productive cough for at least 3 months every year in two consecutive years. If a person has that kind of problem, they definitely have a chronic bronchitis, right? And the thing is, it's actually very important to remember that a person that has chronic bronchitis, for the most part, it affects, not his name is chronic bronchitis. So that means it affects the bronchi, right? So for the most part, the lung parenchyma, for NBME purposes, is spared. This is why the DLCO is roughly normal in a person with chronic bronchitis, right? But contrast this with emphysema, right? So in a person that has emphysema, their airways are enlarged, right? They have like loss of lung parenchyma, right? So because they've lost surface area for diffusion, those people tend to have a decrease in their DLCO. That's a very high yield distinction between emphysema and chronic bronchitis, right? So a person that has COPD will have increased lung volumes. But the way to tell emphysema, apart from chronic bronchitis on NBM exams, is the decrease in DLCO that accompanies emphysema, right? So really in emphysema, you lose a lot of the elasticity of the lungs. And the thing is, the elasticity of the lungs is what keeps your airways open, right? Like your bronchi, your bronchioles and stuff. So when you lose elastin, right, then you're not able to keep your airways open. So your airways begin to collapse. That's why those people begin to retain a ton of CO2. Right. So during expiration, this is very high yield to know. During expiration, those people have collapse. These people have collapse of the airway. Right. So that's, again, important to know. And the thing is, because they retain a lot of CO2, they begin to have all this lung hyperinflation. Their lungs are very compliant. So their lungs become bigger and bigger and bigger. So the thing is, because their lungs are bigger, right, if you think about it, it's much easier to blow a balloon when it's, not completely distended to a distended position than trying to blow a balloon even further that is already distended, right? So because their lungs are already hyperinflated, these people have like increased work of breathing and their respiratory muscles are not particularly efficient, right? And then don't forget, right, emphysema, chronic bronchitis, actually the biggest risk factor for both of those, right, is smoking, right? Cigarette smoking is the biggest risk factor for COPD. But don't forget, right, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency can absolutely cause COPD as well, right? It can cause pan-acinar emphysema. Remember, alpha-1 antitrypsin, basically it's an enzyme, right, that pretty much neutralizes the elastase that comes from neutrophils, right? So the thing is, if you lack alpha-1 antitrypsin, right, then you're not able to neutralize the elastase that comes from neutrophils. And that elastase, well, basically elastase, right, it's an ease that destroys elastin, right? So that will destroy the elastin in the lungs, right? So usually these people get like very early onset COPD, right? And usually when people have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, they usually like have like liver problems because alpha-1 antitrypsin is also found in the liver. And they also tend to get skin problems as well, right? So it's just one of those big things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, just some things I will say, because sometimes they throw these on exams to try to, mess people's heads up. Remember, if a person has like airflow limitations and you give them a bronchodilator and their airflow limitation gets better, those people have asthma. That's it. If the airflow limitation does not get better, they do not have asthma, right? And then remember, bronchiectasis is also another common condition that may pop up on exams. Basically, for whatever bizarre reason, right, these people have like abnormal dilation of their airways, right? And usually they will give you like some imaging finding in the question that, oh, this person has like very thick airways, or you see like a tram track pattern in the distal airway, right? So they'll tell you that the person's airway is thick. They'll tell you that the person's airway looks cystic. That's why it's called bronchiectasis, right? It's almost like ectasia of the airways, right? Whenever you see stuff like that, right, you definitely want to think about bronchiectasis. And usually these people have like a ton of sputum production, although some people may actually not have that ton of sputum production, if you may, right? And the thing is, sometimes your friends at the NBME, especially for those taking step one, they love to go after like the things you may see on histology, right? Or grossly in a person that has COPD, if you're looking at their airways, right? Remember, these people, they have like metaplasia of their airways, right? So instead of having that the pseudostratified columnar epithelium that you find in the airway actually becomes squamous epithelium, right? So they have like a metaplasia to squamous epithelium. That's how you ought to know, right? And then remember all that cilia that helps you move your mucus around. Those things actually begin to not work properly in a person that has COPD, right? And then they have like a ton of like elastic, smooth muscle, a ton of connective tissue that begins to proliferate. So again, just their airway dynamics becomes abnormal, right? Their airway dynamics becomes abnormal. And remember, if you want to reduce mortality in COPD, I'll talk about some other interventions, but the big thing you want to keep in mind is stop smoking, right? If you stop smoking, I mean, it's not like you're going to recover lung function, but the decline in your lung function will basically go back to the exact same level as a person that does not smoke, right? So that's very high yield to know, right? So smoking is basically the most cost-effective, the most clinically effective solution, right? To slow down the progression of COPD. And if you also want to improve survival, right? Remember, the NBME, they love to ask questions on what improves survival, right? What improves survival. And then one thing I just want to mention is, if you see a person on an NBME exam that has like COPD symptoms in their 40s, right? You absolutely want to think about alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, right? And usually for those people, just go ahead and check the alpha-1 antitrypsin levels. If it's less than like 80 milligrams per deciliter, they pretty much have a alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, right? Now, what are some things that the NBME may throw in a COPD question to kind of tell you that, oh, okay, this person has COPD, right? They may tell you that, oh, the person has a loud P2, right? Or a loud S2, right? Because remember, when a person has COPD, right, they become chronically hypoxemic, right? And when you're hypoxemic, right, that's going to cause a pulmonary vascular constriction. And if that happens, right, that will increase the pressures on the right side of the heart, and that can cause pulmonary hypertension, right? So if you see like a loud S2, a loud P2, you absolutely want to think about COPD on an NBME exam, right? Or if they tell you that, oh, the S2 is split, right? If you see like a split like all the time, right? Because remember, you can have a physiologic split on inspiration, because you know, when you inspire, your venous return increases, more blood goes to the right side of the heart. So if that happens, right, you know, it will take a while for all the blood to leave your right side of the heart and for the pulmonic valve to close. So the aortic valve will close before the pulmonic, right? So you have that physiologic split, but it doesn't happen under every other circumstance, right? But if you notice that a person has like that split on inspiration and expiration, right, then you absolutely want to think about like a persistently split S2. That's pathognomonic for a person having like pulmonary hypertension, which, you know, again, can be caused by COPD. Or sometimes they can tell you that, oh, the person on imaging, the person has a parasternal lift to the heart. If you see that, again, that tells you that this person's right heart is not working well, right? The parasternal lift just means that the person has some kind of right ventricular hypertrophy, right? And again, because the person has pulmonary hypertension, right? If a person has like really bad COPD, really bad pulmonary hypertension from COPD, they are going to have a decrease in their pulmonary vascular markings on imaging, right? Remember, those pulmonary vascular markings is an indication of the patency of your pulmonary vessels, right? So if you have a decrease in pulmonary vascular markings, that means the person very likely has some kind of pulmonary hypertension, right? And also don't forget, right, obviously the diaphragm is gonna be flat in a person that has a COPD, right? Because again, of that lung hyperinflation, right? So the diaphragm just kind of like settles down. And then don't forget the big thing you're looking for, FEV1 to FVC ratio. If it's less than 70%, you're done. Person has COPD, right? So again, I'll say that again. If the FEV1 to FVC ratio is less than 70%, the person has COPD, okay? And remember that usually in COPD, all the lung volumes are going to go up, right? Like your total lung capacity, FRC, all that stuff is all going to go up in a person that has a COPD. Again, remember, I said those big high yield things about the DLCO. The DLCO is roughly normal in a person with chronic bronchitis, but the DLCO is decreased in a person that has emphysema, right? Because remember, the diffusion capacity, like the ability to diffuse, right? There's a pulmonary equation that relates that, right? So the diffusion ability, basically diffusion ability, right, is equal to the area divided by the thickness, right? The area divided by the thickness. So if the surface area, so the area is directly proportional to the diffusion capacity, the thickness is inversely proportional to the diffusion capacity, right? So if the surface area available for diffusion is low, then that means the diffusion capacity will be decreased, right? So a decreased surface area for gas exchange, right, is the mechanism behind the hypoxemia that characterizes emphysema, right? And then if a person has pulmonary fibrosis, for example, right, which is more an example of a restrictive lung disease, the thickness in the walls of the lungs goes up, right? So because there's an inverse relationship between the thickness and the diffusibility, right? Because the thickness is up, then the diffusion ability goes down, right? That's the mechanism behind the hypoxemia in a person that has like some kind of fibrosis in the lungs, right? So again, very high yield to know these things for exams, right? So the thing is, for the most part, right, like let's talk about how you manage COPD. Remember, COPD, for the most part, you always want to start with a short-acting bronchodilator, right? So you can start with like a beta-2 agonist, like albuterol. You can also use like a short-acting muscarinic antagonist, right? So something that blocks those muscarinic M3 receptors, right? Something like ipratropium, for example. If that's not cutting it, then go the next step. The next step is to go ahead and add a long-acting agent, right? So you can add a LABA, right? A long-acting beta-2 agonist, something like salmeterol or formoterol, or you can add a long-acting anticholinergic agent, right? Again, a long-acting like muscarinic receptor antagonist, like tiotropium. Remember, ipratropium is the short-acting anticholinergic. Tiotropium is the long-acting anticholinergic, right? And then if those things are not working, right, then you go ahead and add an inhaled corticosteroid. If that's not working, then you want to begin to make sure, you know, you're adding like home oxygen. We'll talk about the criteria for that in a bit, right? And you can also begin to consider things like surgery, right? Like there's this common surgery that sometimes you may see on an MBM exam, right? Like it's called lung volume reduction surgery, right? But remember, before you do that stuff, you got to check the person's FEV1. If the person's FEV1 is less than a liter, that's a contraindication to any kind of lung resective surgery, right? Because the person will not have enough lung remaining, right, to participate in gas exchange, so they're going to die on the operating table, right? You obviously do not want that. So remember the stepwise progression of COPD treatment, right? So short-acting stuff first, long-acting stuff first, inhaled corticosteroids, and then oxygen therapy plus or minus surgery, right? Contrast that with asthma. Asthma, you start with the short-acting stuff first, right? A SABA, right? Like albuterol, right? And then after that, you go to an inhaled corticosteroid. So it's almost like the second and third places are swapped between COPD and asthma management, right? So you do the inhaled corticosteroid second for asthma. Third, you do the LABA, right? Like salmeterol, formoterol. And then fourth, you can then do oral steroids, right? You can then do oral steroids. And the thing is, there are just some weird, unusual questions your friend said the NBME love to, you know, test in terms of like managing people that have COPD. Again, obviously, again, you're going to tell these people, stop smoking, stop smoking, stop smoking, right? These people should get the influenza vaccines every year, right? That's very, very important, right? And remember, people that have COPD are also candidates for the pneumococcal vaccine, right? Especially those that are over 65, right? I mean, obviously, if they're less than 65, you still want to give them the regular vaccine. You give them the PCV13 first before you give them the PPSV23, right? But the thing is, if they're over 65 and they've gotten their vaccines like more than 5 years ago, right? Go ahead and revaccinate them against the pneumococcus. This is absolutely important to know for exams, right? And then remember that there are many different ways you can give those inhaled agents to a person that has COPD, right? You know, you can use like a meter dose inhaler, right? You can use a spacer, you can use a nebulizer. The thing is, sometimes on NBM exams, they try to get you to pick one over the other for a person, right? Now, the thing is, if a person has like a lot of physical limitations, like they have like really bad arthritis, or for some reason, like their coordination is not great, let's say they've had a stroke or something, then a nebulizer is the agent of choice in those people, right? The thing is, for you to use a metered dose inhaler, you need to have like good body mechanics and stuff like that, right? And then obviously the thing that is the best of the best is a spacer, right? But usually they'll try to get you to pick between a metered dose inhaler and a nebulizer. Again, use a nebulizer in people that for some reason just have like weird body mechanics, pulmonary activity to allow them to inhale those things, right? But an MDI, if you have good instructions and, you know, you're able to use it properly, right? I mean, it's equivalent to a nebulizer in how much medication that you get, right? And then sometimes they love to test side effects of these drugs, right? Of the drugs that are used for COPD. Remember, if a person has a COPD, right, and they're taking like a beta 2 agonist, remember, those things can cause tremors, those things can cause an increase in heart rate, because literally those things are beta 2 agonists, right? But the thing is, they do have some beta 1 activity, so they can absolutely increase a person's heart rate. And then remember, these anticholinergic drugs, right, you know, again, they basically block cholinergic receptors on salivary glands, right? So these things can pretty much, you know, cause dry mouth, right? And then also remember, if a person has like closed angle glaucoma, these muscarinic antagonists are not, you know, are not a great idea. And also remember, your parasympathetic system makes you pee, right? So if, for example, a person has like BPH, right, or a person has like urinary obstruction for any reason, again, these anticholinergic agents will be contraindicated in those people, right? Then remember, right, you can also use theophylline in some select patients, although theophylline is a very toxic drug, has like a super narrow therapeutic index, right? And remember, it can cause a lot of like cardiac arrhythmias, right? Cause a lot of nausea, a lot of vomiting, right? And remember, basically, the way theophylline works, it's a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. So by doing that, it will increase the amount of cyclic AMP in the smooth muscle that lines your airways, and that will cause like a bronchodilation, right? That's also the same way there's this drug known as a roflumilast, right? Roflumilast is a phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitor. So by inhibiting phosphodiesterase, right, again, it will bump up your levels of cyclic AMP, and that will cause a smooth muscle relaxation and vasodilation in your airways, right? And again, remember, when a person has COPD, one thing that can improve survival besides smoking cessation, right, is oxygen, right? Although they need this HOMO2, they need this oxygen for at least 15 hours a day, right? They need it for at least 15 hours a day. And there are some criteria you want to know for the purposes of exams on who should get HOMO2, right? So remember, if the person's P little AO2, if they are, you know, the partial pressure of oxygen they are in their arteries, right, if it's less than 55, you know, 55 or less, so 55 is included, right? So 55 or less millimeters of mercury, right? Or their O2 sats are like less than 88%, again, 88% is included, right? Then those people should get a HOMO2. I mean, like, the criteria is a little higher. I just remember this as the rule of nines, right? So just add nines to those initial numbers, right? So if your arterial PO2 is 59 or less, or your O2 sat is 89% or less, but you have pulmonary hypertension, then you're also eligible for HOMO2. And also, if the person has, like, evidence of, like, right heart failure, you know, like, bad core pulmonality, they have like right heart failure, their right ventricle is not working well on an echocardiogram, or they have like edema and all that stuff, or even if you have like a very high hematocrit, right, telling you that, oh, this person has polycythemia, these people are all, you know, eligible for HOMO2 therapy, right? And then if a person has COPD exacerbations, right, again, the big thing you'll see on an MBM exam is these people, they have a bad change from baseline, right? So they have a bad change from baseline. What in the world do I mean by that? Basically, like, they are coughing more, they are producing more sputum, stuff like that, right? And really, the most common causes on MBM exams of a COPD exacerbation, the first one you should think about is infection, right? But also, if you inhale a lot of air pollutants, that can also cause a COPD exacerbation. But the big one I want you to think about on MBM exams, right, is infection. And usually, you know, if a person has a COPD exacerbation, you're gonna, you know, give them like a short acting agent, you're gonna give them IV like a short acting bronchodilator, right, like albuterol, ipratropium, stuff like that, right? And then don't forget that these people, if for some reason, for some bizarre reason, the MBM is trying to get you to pick between albuterol and ipratropium as a short-acting agent to treat COPD, pick albuterol first, okay? Pick albuterol first. Albuterol is just generally preferred, right? Over the, over like ipratropium, for example, in those circumstances, right? And again, you're going to give those people like IV steroids, right? And in addition to that, if, you know, let's say you're trying all these things, it's not working, then your next step on an MBM exam is to give these people like non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, right? So basically like BiPAP or CPAP, right? The thing is, that stuff actually reduces mortality, right, in a person that has a COPD exacerbation. But again, remember, there are some high yield contraindications for this stuff, right? So if for some reason, just basically think of a person that can aspirate, right? A person that can aspirate, or a person that has like tons and tons and tons of secretions. When you see people like that, those people are not eligible for those, right? In those circumstances, unfortunately, you need to proceed to intubating those people, right? Again, you may say, why is divine making a big, big fuss about all this stuff? I promise you, all the stuff I'm saying is floridly high yield to know for the exam, right? It's floridly high yield to know for the exam. And usually when a person has a COPD, like a COPD exacerbation, one thing you usually try to do is you try to actually give those people like antibiotics, because usually people that are going through COPD, you know, again, like I said, infection is one of the most common causes of a COPD exacerbation, right? So the thing is, what are some bugs that can cause problems in a person that's, you know, going through a COPD exacerbation? The most common one that you absolutely want to think about on exams is H flu, right? Haemophilus influenza on NBM exams is probably the most common cause of pneumonia in patients that have COPD, right? Although you can also see like Moraxella or like strep pneumo, but again, the big one I want you to think about is Haemophilus influenza, right? So usually when a person has like a COPD exacerbation, if you're trying to give them like antibiotics, right, one thing you should consider is give them like a third generation cephalosporin, you know, like ceftriaxone, and then you can add like a macrolide like azithromycin, right? So you can do ceftriaxone plus azithromycin. But if you don't see that as an option, you can also just give them monotherapy with like an IV fluoroquinolone, right? And remember, to reduce the risk of those people coming back to the hospital, right, you need to give them like a 3 to 5 day course of oral steroids, right? That's actually one of the things that actually reduces the risk of readmission. Again, you may say, why is Divine making all these fussy points? I promise you, this stuff is floridly high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE exams. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here today. If you're studying for Step 2 CK and you need like an MBME test taking strategies course or the 10-hour comprehensive review course, I'm going to be holding those next week, right? So the 10-hour comprehensive review course, I'm splitting it into 2 days, the 13th and the 14th. It's 5 hours each day. It's from like 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on both of those days. And then the test taking strategies course is on the 12th, right, from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So again, if you're interested in any of those, just shoot me an email through the contact button on the website, and I'll be happy to provide some more information. And again, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcast, on Google Play, on Spotify. I also have these podcasts available on on the website, obviously. Again, if you sign up on the website, then you'll be getting emails when I make new podcasts. And please also subscribe to the YouTube channel. That's where you can find many of my videos. Although, again, you can also find those on the website. So thank you for listening to me ramble for a bit. I hope you have a wonderful day, and I am praying for peace in America. So thank you for listening. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.